There are problems here that we have to face. In the first place, on the level of causation, we are dealing with matters that can only be presented symbolically. Actually, the purpose of most of your great cosmological systems is to create an internal picture, a mandala, a meditation image, which the individual must unfold according to the capacities of his consciousness at any given time. Therefore, we are not dealing with problems such as a map of the city of Los Angeles, where each step of the way can be examined and checked. We are dealing with great abstract conceptions. And these conceptions, in their turn, change in meaning as we grow. We think we have them solved, but our own unfoldment is forever challenging us to search more deeply into this basic mystery which underlies all things. So we are dealing with truth or principles in a mystery. And words fail, thoughts fail. But perhaps out of the effort to grasp, we release from ourselves something of the archetypal design. For the most part, these abstract subjects are profitable to us only in one way, that they increase our confidence or understanding about the kind of a universe in which we live. They help us to find more solid footings for faith upon laws and principles, which, partly understood, still blaze out in splendor, giving us an assurance that we live not in an accident, but in a great intention. Probably that is the largest lesson that we can immediately learn. For the details of this intention have been theological controversies since the dawn of time. Yet each individual gradually outgrows both the theology and the controversy. He finally comes to seek the experience of the great creative processes within himself. He is aided in this because he is a miniature of all things. In an orderly universe, creation occurs on numerous levels, and these levels, in a concatenation, that is, in a descent from higher to lower, these levels follow the same archetypal pattern, and if the trestle board can be sensed or grasped at least in part, it supplies a useful key to the innumerable particulars which may be of concern to us. There is an ancient belief or doctrine concerning septenary, which I think may be abstractly useful. Some of our most remote ancestors in the great philosophical schools declared that the whole of cosmos, the entire vast universal system of universes in which we exist, is built upon a vast mathematical formula. Whether we want to say that the formula came first, or the universe blazed this formula into existence, perhaps is a fine point. But one thing we do feel or believe that is sustained by the deepest knowledge that we have, namely, as Plato says, God geometrizes. The creating power, whatever we wish to designate it, manifesting its own nature according to its own will, moves inevitably in a patterned way, in an orderly way, in a way suitable to the gradual unfoldment of a system of emanations, all of them orderly, consistent, and proper. Also, according to this ancient belief, the differentiations of universal systems, of cosmic systems, and of solar systems, this differentiation was due to basic formulas contained within the great formula. Therefore, every creation, every solar system, and everything created within it is determined by a basic formula unique to each structure. Thus, the formula which manifests itself in our creation defines both the creator and the creation. And another creation, another system, may emanate from a different formula. This formula determines the pattern, determines the type of life, the growth, the motive, and the end. And this formula, in turn, is dependent upon an infinite pattern of formulas, which together form the master plan of all. In our subconscious human thinking, and in our racial experience, in our psychology, philosophy, and religion, we have always accepted the peculiar sacredness of the number seven. And we are therefore impelled to assume that the key number upon which our entire solar life unfolds is a pattern based upon the esoteric powers and significances of the number seven. This is why septenaries of various kinds are eternally present, because from the basic archetypal trestle board, from the master plan, all things infinitely reproduce themselves in kind, so that everything within the creation bears witness to its master key. And this master key for us, for our creation, the ancients declared to be a septenary, an unfoldment of all things through the mystery of the number seven. Now, this mystery itself can intrigue us for an incredible period of time. I have seen magnificent calculations built upon it, vast patterns unfolded through it. But for our purpose, in the time that we have, we cannot attempt to trace all of this material. We will trace certain phases of it. But our principle rests upon the ancient conviction that the archetypal pattern of this solar system is septenary, and therefore that this septenary power is the geometrical energy of the creating principle as it relates to this creation and to all of the parts that manifest within this creation. Now, in a previous discussion, we attempted, from a Buddhistic standpoint, to define the nature of consciousness in relationship to what we term mind, or the illusional intellectual fixation. And we remember that Buddha considered sleep to be the most approximate symbol of consciousness, and that it is from this mysterious root, this unconditioned state, into which the sensory perceptions and the aggregates or hindrances of illusional activity all retire, that in this basic state of not being objectively aware is a type of consciousness which survives without action, survives without self-knowing, survives without imparting knowledge, And that this consciousness furthermore possesses within itself the power to awaken itself into objectivity from the mystery of sleep. Thus sleep carries within it certain rhythms, certain habits, natural and inevitable to itself. And the individual desiring to awake at a certain time the next morning will awake, although he is not conscious of the circumstances that caused him to awaken. The continuity of this purpose was carried through what we call unconsciousness to be revived again when the need arose. This same principle corresponds to certain very early Asian teachings. For here we find the statement in the standards of Zen or standards of contemplation or meditation that the eternal parent, wrapped in its seven mysterious and invisible robes, slumbered again for seven eternities. And we also learn that time was not, for it lay asleep in the infinite bosom of duration. Universal mind was not, for there was no vehicle to contain it. Now this represents then the sleeping world, or the sleeping state of root consciousness. We have already pointed out that this problem, the innate nature of consciousness itself, we cannot fathom. We do not know the consciousness as it is, in absconditas, without manifestation, without self-awareness, but simply existing. Yet in the ancient systems, all things that were fashioned, all things that were emanated, all things that were created, emerged from the inscrutable mystery of the eternal state of consciousness, which we liken to sleep. Therefore, that in the pralayas or the great nights of the gods, things sleep. And in the dawn of new cycles of manifestation, things awaken. Waken as we do, out of the mystery of an eternal law which preceded sleep. For all creation as we know it is recreation. All manifestation as we know it is an emergence from non-manifestation, which in turn was preceded by manifestation. And as the universe is itself a vast unfolding thing, sweeping like a huge population through space, we are also confronted with the mystery of life around us as we see it. Living things are forever being born and forever dying, but life is forever going on. Humanity is composed of an infinite number of perishable beings, that is, as far as their external natures are concerned. Yet humanity has a strangely imperishable quality about it, for it goes on through a constant process of recreation. All human beings coming into birth in the daily existence we know are not born at the same time. Some are born while others are old. Some are born and others die. Some are born nearly at the same time. But there is forever a borning and forever a dying. And yet the vast body of life goes on. Such is the mystery as it emanates from space. There are worlds coming out of space. There are worlds existing in space. There are worlds disappearing in space. But space itself, an eternal principle, is never empty of creations, never without something emerging or something departing, something coming forth or something retiring. Thus suns and planets and great systems are forever being born, forever fulfilling their destinies, and forever returning again to the mystery of sleep, to the mystery of infinite absolute causation. And this timeless, dimensionless, ageless thing which can never die because it knows neither birth nor death, but within which is an infinite capacity of morning and dying, of forever awaking, so that it appears as though every germ which floats in this mystery can be touched for the fire of creativity and burst into a world, and that having passed its proper span, it fades back into the mystery from which it came. And in the back of the great meditation image, then, of your creative processes is this vast concept of an eternal potential, forever producing potencies, an eternal principle, forever flowing into manifestations that are temporal or non-eternal. But the one foreverness in the whole pattern being this forever of livingness, which comes into manifestation forever. Now, some systems have assumed that at the very root and source of the totality is an infinite form of this vast, pre-conceivable thing, this thing that simply cannot be known, because totality cannot be grasped by parts. The totality knows its parts, but they do not know it. So the universe is infinite capacity, always being filled with infinite potential, and going on and on and on. So the first power of the ancient Godhead was this resident, simple fact of consciousness itself, which may have a pre-existence existence in its nature, a consciousness represented as consisting of two states, one a state of eternal sleep, and the other a state of non-eternal awaking. So that consciousness never fully awakes. Consciousness never fully sleeps, yet consciousness is forever both sleeping and waking. Consciousness as itself, per se, is the infinite root of life, and therefore it has been declared to possess within it the slumbering power of the first manifestation of its own nature, and that is infinite creativity. So at the root of every great system of theology is the Creator. And the Creator is the potential to make known, to make manifest, to make apparent, to bring forth out of sleep into waking. Now in most of your great systems, the creative act, the primary creation, the speaking of the eternal word or verbum, that which causes the break in the mysterious chain of sleep, that which disturbs the sleeper into waking, the divine fiat, is associated with the creative power. And once this power has struck, the light has come, creation has been objectified, we find very, very little further reference to this power. This power then simply rests as the infinite storehouse, the infinite source of all things that are ultimately to be made manifest. Therefore, in most theologies, you find very little actual definition, very little explanation, very little even veneration for this principle in itself. Now we will find, for instance, throughout the world, temples to many deities, but there are very few temples to the simple principle of universal consciousness itself. In Christendom, for example, you will find very few churches dedicated to God per se. You will find deity worship through attributes. but symbols of absolute deity. Churches, temples, or shrines in honor of this absolute deity are comparatively rare. When you compare the number of churches, for example, in Christendom that are dedicated to Christ, you do not find nearly so many in which the dedication is directly to the first power of the Godhead. This first power of the Godhead is always represented as a strangely aloof power, bringing things forth and then remaining in the shadow behind them. Now, we have many symbolisms to represent what might be termed the dawning of consciousness, the first creativity in this great emanational theory. In Taoism and in Zen, for example, the primary symbol of creation is a circle. Now, this is perhaps contrary to our more common concept, for we nearly always think of the creating power first as a being. In your esoteric and philosophical systems, however, a being is not the first. Being is the first. And therefore, the circle, as a symbol of infinity, represents to the mind of the symbolist, as a mandala, an infinite field of consciousness, a field infinite as far as we can conceive, and yet in the background of the vaster systems of which this is but a small fragment, a restricted or limited field. It is, however, the peculiar zone, area, or field, which is to become involved in the creation of a system of some kind. And in antiquity, the supreme being in nature, universal consciousness, was usually considered as an area. It was considered as a diffusion, as an infiniteness, with its center everywhere and its circumference nowhere. And strangely enough, this consciousness, which represents actually the field of creativity of a logos, or deity, was a circle, or more correctly, a sphere. But the sphere diagrammatically becomes a circle, which is a symbol of a very abstract quality, representing an area impregnated with a consciousness, or with a life principle. The first power, or the first principle, therefore, in symbolism, was usually represented as defined as a circle, a great area set aside for germination, for the generation of worlds, the ring pass not, the shell of the mysterious world egg within which the fecundation of life is to take place. This is Atma. This is the superior nature. This is consciousness without the implication of selfhood. Consciousness without self-consciousness. Existence in a kind of trance-like sleep, permeating, penetrating, extending, but not yet focused or drawn to any particular point, because it is everywhere. Now, Behme, the German mystic, attempts to help us with this thinking through his own mystical speculations and visions. And he explains that in this vast area, which is actually the body of the creating principle, undifferentiated, but nevertheless there, as in a mysterious alchemical vessel, a circular globe with walls of glass, within this, the great alchemy of creation unfolds. And this alchemy is primarily made possible through the second principle or power of the basic creative triad. And this second power, the ancients sometimes referred to as formation. Now, formation is the root of form. And form is a kind of condition. Form and matter are not the same. Form is always a compound. For a form must possess at least two attributes, two natures, two substances, or a principle and a substance. It must be less than totality and more than the condition inferior to itself. Thus, formation, which was what the Kabbalists sometimes referred to this situation, was the process of bringing forth, not upon a level of generation, but upon the level of consciousness. Generation upon the level of consciousness, the ancients conceived to be formation, or structures brought forth, as the Hindu says, by will and yoga. And by formation in this process, Beni explains that there is a vast motion, a motion that moves along a radius, and that this motion is from the circumference of the vast circle of life to its center. Gradually, all of this field moves toward its own center, leaving behind it what the ancients called privation. And Beni refers to when he says bis and abyss, the abyss being that which is left. And the gradual bringing together or moving together of the spiritual energies of an area results in these energies moving toward a center, leaving behind them an area privated of their own natures. And this privated area becomes the basis of what we call matter. Now, matter is not the absence of life, but the life deprived of certain attributes, the creative attributes which have been drawn to the center. Matter is just as much alive as anything else in space, but certain consciousness, intelligence factors have been drawn toward the center along these radial lines from the circumference. And when they unite in the center to form the dot in the circle, we then have the gradual emergence of the third logos, or the third power of the creating principle. And this third power was called by the ancients the universal thought. Now, how shall we fix this thought perhaps a little more adequately in our mind? Consciousness is superior to thought. Therefore, thought can come into existence in consciousness. Now, less than consciousness, but more than thought, is something else for which we need a word. And the scriptures give us one word that is applicable. It is something that is a little more than thought, but less than consciousness. And one word that has been suggested for it is understanding. Understanding being a power which can transcend thought. It is good to think, but it is better to understand. But it is still better to be fully conscious. These things represent degrees. Now, in your great group of creative principles, we have then this triad of the Platonists, the one, or the eternal, the beautiful, the understanding, and the good, which is the divine thought. We also have, therefore, creation moving through an understanding from within itself towards the integration of primary thought. Now, thought is an interesting point, because in your esoteric doctrine, thought is not a product of mind. Mind is a product of thought. Mind it follows thought. It does not precede it. The eternal thinker brings into existence an infinite diversity of minds, which become the channels of the eternal thought. But the mind does not come first. The thought comes first. The thought is universal. The mind is finite. The thought represents the series of archetypal ideas that are resident within the divine nature itself. Thus we have creation moving through formation into the establishment of the focal point of generation. Thought, therefore, becoming a symbol of generating power. A formation becoming a symbol of the processes of universal understanding. Creation being the manifestation of the infinite life itself according to its own inevitable nature. Thus we have a triad now which constitute the three basic principles of existence. This triad returns to us in every line of thought, every religion, every philosophy. But it represents three essential natures, a symbol of the primary colors of life. And we find references to these in medieval philosophy, in the treatises and essays on the colors of good and evil, the colors of light and darkness. And of course, the color symbolism, which was very important throughout religion and is still very important in the vesture of the clergy and things of that nature. The triad, then, consists of a gradual retiring of all things from their vast circumferential area towards the ultimate establishment of a point of unity. All moving toward the state of oneness. Oneness emerging from allness. Oneness becoming an imperishable island in the midst of allness. We find this in the Kojiki in Japan, where the gods caused the abyss to release this imperishable mudland by dipping their spears into the infinite and bringing them up with this ilus or slime on the point. And this formed an island on the surface of the sea of the infinite. So here was the sea of the infinite in the Japanese basic Shinto religion as creativity itself. The gods representing the formators, the great units of understanding, and the island brought up upon the point of their spears, the universal thought upon which all things were to be erected. The universal thought is therefore, we will say, the least of the three great principles. Yet into it has been gradually drawn or focused these potentials. And we now have what the Kabbalists call Kethoth, the crown. First the closed eye of the infinite, and finally the eye that blazes open. And we have creation going to sleep when the great eye closes. And we have it awaking when the great eye opens. The eye, of course, the pupil of the eye, is very symbolically a dot in a circle, so that it represents the symbol. And for the creating power itself, the Kabbalah removes the eyelid, because it is stated in the scripture, the God of Israel neither slumbers nor sleeps. So this great open eye is the symbol of the universe blazing forth. It is the all-seeing eye. But it exists as deity upon the level of universal thought. Behind universal thought, which is the Manasa principle, monastic field of Buddhism, lies the second or mysterious Buddhic level, which is that of understanding, or, in the term of man, illumination. Behind that is Atma, the eternal, that which can know only itself, and to which all things must return, either by the long road of evolution, or by the shorter path of discipline. For discipline is nothing but evolution under the control of intelligence or enlightenment. So we have three powers now represented, and here we must pause for a moment in our study of this septenary. We have begun with Atma, Buddhi, and Manas. We have come to the monastic field, which is the field of the great thoughts. Now, how shall we understand this thought? How shall we understand the non-eternal thought of the eternal thinker? What is this thought, actually? How shall we attempt to define it, other than to say that it is a great center, a great radiating focal point for a creation that is to emerge from it, and therefore that the focal point between creator and creation is this mysterious vortex of thought. This vortex of thought is the third Grand Master of the Lodge of Jerusalem. It is the third power. It is the master builder. It is the power upon which depends the entire emanation of a world or an existence or a creation. Now, this thought itself in Indian philosophy is usually represented by a mendicant, sometimes by the deity Shiva. Usually, however, it is represented by a being in manifestation, but also in meditation, performing either the Vedantic or yogic mystery. For we come now to what might become the basis of either Hindu or Chinese mentalism, and which probably underlies most of the mentalistic sects that have arisen among Western people. Namely, that creation in manifestation is entirely a mystery of the release of thought. That this world as we know it, a manifestation, is built upon the mysterious cross thunderbolt of thought. This is a mental creation. It is a creation lying in the divine mind. And therefore, the ancients conceived it as an internalization, that actually the creating power in a kind of yogic suspension internal visualized an existence, vitalized it, and sustained it within its own consciousness. And your universe is a thought in the divine mind. It is a thought, however, which precedes mind as we know it, existing in the divine nature rather than in the human mind, as we are inclined to use the term. Again, our terms are difficult, unfortunate, and must sometimes be used in a contradictory manner because we have no other terms to use. Context alone can help us to keep the pattern straight. From then, let us see where we are with our concept of the basic nature of the creation process. We now have the great seal, the Ungrund of Buddha, of Beni. We have in the midst of it the blazing center of the divine thought. All this is invisible, totally beyond our conception of things, for the sun and moon and stars as we know them have not entered upon the horizon of our conception. These things rest not in matter alone, but in superior worlds. And the visible sun, as Paracelsus tells us, is actually the third sun, and there are two invisible ones behind it. This also would carry the concept of the Godhead. The great or first sun, being the spiritual, the second, the Christ or illuminate sun, and the third, the universal thought. But we think very often of the thought as something shining, the light of thought, the luminosity of the intellectual enlightenment that comes from the dawn of wisdom or reason within living things. The ancients and their astronomy also gave us an interesting point to remember, that the true sun is not in the center of the solar system, but the solar system is within the body of the true sun, which extends beyond the orbits of all its planets, forming a vast field of conscious life energy, and that it truly, that this
great Son is the one in which we live and move and have our being. And in the magnetic field of the human being, this corresponds to the auric egg, or the circumference of the electromagnetic field of the body. For in man, the consciousness is not in the body, but the body is in the consciousness. And the consciousness itself recapitulates this process, focalizing to produce thought, but actually extending throughout the entire field. And therefore, perhaps paralleling the idea of Plato, namely that souls, lives, beings falling into generations come from the circumference of this great system and not from the center, and that suns and planets falling into generation fall from the Milky Way or the great embryonic field of stars, which the ancients regarded as a vast organism in space. But our purpose is merely to summarize this situation and to say that finally the great triad of invisibles, of causes, of principles, of divine attributes, this triad finally becomes manifested, not visible, but manifested through the first tangible thing with which we are capable of struggling in an effort to understand, and that is universal thought. Now, universal thought is also something not imprisoned. The ancients said that the universal thought was azonic, as its name implied, that it was universal. Therefore, that all thought is a diminishing from this universal polarization. Thought is a unit. Thought is a oneness, extending again throughout the entire nature of existence. There is only one thought, although there may be an infinite diversity of thinkers. One thought sustains all mentality, all mental processes, and this thought itself is the luminous mind capacity of deity. It is the archetypal thinking, the thought, or the Hermes of the Hermetic axioms. For it is said that thought wrote all books, one thought producing all thinkers who in turn attempt to solve the mystery of ignorance and establish wisdom. So in the midst of a great field deprived by the energies which have been drawn to form this great focal point, blazes the invisible intellectual sun, the sun of thought. And now what happens? We have come into a situation that somewhat resembles an hourglass. We have brought the great creativity downward to a focal point in universal thought. From this focal point, it expands downwardly in quality, not in direction, but in quality, qualitative descent. And what it does then is to begin to flow into the field that was left privated by the reduction of energies, as these were drawn to the center to form this great focal central luminosity. Therefore, thought begins to move inevitably into the privated area, moving inevitably over the area that was previously occupied by consciousness. But it moves upon a lower level than consciousness. It moves downward into objectivity as we know it. Now, there are many degrees of this and many processes of it, but for our simple purpose, let us assume, for example, that creation or creative power was moved downward as through a funnel until it reached the bottom of the funnel, which was the focal point of thought, and then passing out of the funnel begins to diverge again to form the lower half of the hourglass, in which it begins to flow into the field left deprived. But this field is now receiving an influx on a lower level than that from which it was originally deprived. So gradually the thought begins to fashion matter. It permeates matter. and becomes the basis of something that is to follow. And thought, permeating matter, sets up a twofold motion. This twofold motion consists of the descent of the thought principle itself, and as a result of the impregnation of matter by the universal thought energy, a gradual evolutionary process in matter. Matter begins to grow upward by the Gnostic doctrine of emanation. Matter begins to ascend to meet the descent of the life principles. And gradually, out of this ascent of matter and the descent of energy, we find the rise of creatures. We find the growth and manifestation of all things. Now, thought, having passed downward now into the state of generation from which it is to operate, we have an important consideration held by our ancient brethren. First of all, that the mundane creation, or the objective generation, whatever it may be, has its root in the universal thought. That it is an inverted tree growing downward, to be met by another tree growing upward out of the abyss, and that these two trees ultimately mingle their branches to form one tremendous structure. A structure of internal descending power and external ascending power. These two meet on various levels, and according to their degrees of meeting and the levels on which they meet, species, types, kinds, worlds, planets, everything relating to the inner structure of a creation begins to come into manifestation. Actually, in the descent of this principle also, thought becomes the apex or the top point of the pyramid of generations. All things have their generating origin from thought. And man, as a generating being, ultimately becomes a mental or thought creator, but not as yet in his present evolution. Thought out of itself, then, also begins to develop objectively a new center of manifestation. And here in the monastic field, thought gradually identifies its first integration, and that integration is mind. Now, mind is the body of thought. And mind and thought together constitute a compound. And this mind-thought compound becomes the upper point of what was called in antiquity the Great Square, or the symbolical figure, which you may remember from ancient mythology, of the triangle combined with the square. And how the triangle falling into the square becomes the symbol of creation or generation on an objective or material plane. Now, the square has always been the ancient symbol of matter. So we have three essential symbols involved in this. We have the circle or sphere, which is the symbol of total consciousness. We have the triangle or pyramid, which is the symbol of the creative triad. We have the square, or the cube, which is the symbol of the material creation. Spirit, soul, body. These three together. Of course, the principle being rather obvious, that the circle or sphere is a symmetrical geometric body with an infinite number of faces. And that this rests upon the least point upon which any solid can rest, for there is no solid that can rest upon less of itself than a sphere, whereas the cube rests theoretically upon the greatest part of its own surface. The triangle rests upon a rather different basis, because the triangle corresponds to an ascending line from below in the form of a pyramid, or a descending arc from above in the form of the creative triad. all of this symbolism becomes a little confusing, but after a little thinking, I think it makes a reasonably simple picture. And the lowest of the creating principles, thought, meeting or working with the highest level of the creation, or the deprived field, produces out of this union mind. Now mind becomes then man's highest body, and becomes the instrument most closely connected with universal thought. And through the mind and its evolution and development, the universal thought flows into objectivity, flows also into all the spheres of creation which are below mind. You will remember in the study of color that your three primary colors give rise to your four secondaries. Now, the peculiar situation of all four secondaries is that they are all of them composed of two or more primaries. Therefore, all of these things are forms, because form is a compound. Form, therefore, becoming into manifestation, is always a certain degree of thought plus a certain degree of matter. In man, the thought power transcends matter more than it does in the animal. And in the animal, the compound contains more thought than in the plant. The plant more than in the mineral. But all these compounds of the thought and matter represent forms. Therefore, the square is called the universe of forms, because within it, formal natures are forever being manifested. The square, therefore, contains the outworking of the three principles in their manifestation as four capacities. For the principles of the triad are forever flowing into the capacity of the cube, square, or the lower formal structure. Now, in the case of man, these four represent the body principles. In the case of the universe, they represent the magnetic fields, which become the foundation of the differentiation of energies. Thought, therefore, actually becomes the basis of the four bodies. And each one of these bodies is some kind of a condition of thought. Therefore, we may say that thought, or the thinking power, can understand them all. But they, in turn, cannot understand the thinking power. Thought can perhaps conceive mind. It has conceived it and brought it into being. But mind can never conceive the fullness of unconditioned thought. As your meditational processes are attempts of mind to grasp the larger dimension of thought. A very complicated but interesting procedure. We have then a series of other creative powers emerging now from the thought principle. One of these, we have said, is mind. Now, on the combination, or in the field of mind, in the case of man and other creatures higher than man, the union of the thought and the mental field or energy of matter produces what we call in man the ego. And the ego becomes, so to say, the god of bodies. And this god of bodies is seated in the mental field of the human being. And it is this that causes man to verge inevitably toward mental attitude and to place the ego above all other considerations. The ego-mind-thought compound is again a triad. For the thought becomes the first person, the mind becomes the second, and the compound of these becomes the third, or the ego. The ego, in turn, is the generator, and from the generating power of the ego, the lower bodies are projected into existence. These lower bodies in the creative processes being unfoldments or manifestations of potentials, being the power, for example, released through body, of emotion, or the power of growth, or the power of subsistence, which is the peculiar nature of physical matter. Thus we have, from the creative triad, the power to think, the power to feel, the power to grow, and the power to exist temporally or physically as an integrated compound. Now, each of these things are powers. These, in turn, including the power of subsistence or physical integration, which means a kind of energy that holds the physical body together but is not the physical body. The power of sustaining a body, of substantiating it, depends upon a kind of energy which is called a binder. It holds. At death, this binder is removed. Therefore, the body disintegrates. The power to integrate, disintegrate is a kind of energy also. So we have the power of thought, emotion, growth, and subsistence, or continuance in form. These constitute the quaternary, or the four secondary attributes, all of which also lie within the superior. But these four are definitely dependent upon thought and emerge from it. Therefore, to feel, to think, to grow, to subsist are actually under the power of the thought principle. Now, when all these things are grouped together, we have seven basic powers, of which three are primary and four are secondary, but altogether they are inevitably necessary in the compound which we call a solar system. And they are also necessary in the highest visible being that we know in that solar system, namely man himself. Actually, furthermore, we now have a human being without a body. We have his power to make one. We have his power to keep one, for a time at least. We have his power to hold the atoms together, but we have no body. Because the ancients point out that body, which is the substance or formal principle itself in its lowest degree, is not a principle. Body is not a principle. Therefore, body was the eighth sphere of the ancients. Body is the grave. Body is the physical capacity. It is the cup into which all these energies flow. Body is, therefore, the great container of principles. And once these principles have been locked within the body, then the body becomes the symbol of this deprived matter, which I mentioned before. And all these principles moving into it begin to work through it. And in the universe or solar system, the body is composed of all of the physical members of that system, being the bodies of the planets and the luminaries. Therefore, the Earth is part of the body of a solar system, just as our own physical bodies belong to us. So seven principles flowing into a container or receptacle, which becomes both the tomb and the womb of these powers. It becomes the tomb because in it these powers die, but the womb because from it these powers are reborn in the great evolutionary processes of nature. Thus we have the descent of the seven creative principles which are ultimately locked in matter. And being locked in matter, they then begin the process of breaking through matter, which they do by a very gradual evolutionary process in reversal of the order of their descent. The Egyptian philosophers had a very interesting concept of that, because they said that part of the septenary came into every part of the formal principle, and that the highest principle was reflected in the lowest aspect or attribute of matter. Therefore, the ancient Egyptians said that consciousness per se, in its physical existence in man, for example, exists in the skeleton, that it exists in the marrow, in the bones, that it therefore is associated with the most crystallized